He had survived the blacklist. He had suffered 4 decades of exile with dignity and integrity, and he had unequivocally proven that alternatives to Copenhagen were possible. His work put the lie to von Neumann's proof and directly prompted Bell's marvelous theorem. If John Bell was the father of the quantum revival, then surely David Bohm had been its grandfather. Bohm's pilot wave interpretation wasn't the only old idea dusted off as quantum foundations gained ground in the wake of the Bell experiments. Dieter Zee also found new recognition for his work on decoherence, thanks to an unlikely source, John Wheeler. After his failure to reconcile his student Everett's work with the ideas of his mentor Bohr, Wheeler had set aside his interest in the foundations of quantum theory. But the Bell experiments, as well as long talks with Eugene Wigner, his colleague at Princeton, had brought Wheeler back to his former interest in the subject. Shortly after moving to the University of Texas in 1976, Wheeler started teaching a class on quantum measurements, and, as he had done at Princeton, he attracted a group of brilliant students, some of whom were profoundly affected by Wheeler's course. "Until I met John Wheeler in Austin, Texas, I had assumed that all of the deep questions were understood, or in any case not an appropriate subject for a student," said Wojciech Zurek, one of Wheeler's students. "Wheeler changed that. In his class, we read Bohr and Einstein, but we also discussed connections between quantum theory and information and played with ideas. I became gradually convinced that questions about quantum mechanics, the role of the observer, and the nature of information in physics are important and largely open." Zurek's work in Wheeler's class, along with a David Deutsch lecture he attended in Texas, got him thinking about the relationship between entanglement and measurement in quantum physics, and specifically the effects of entanglement between a quantum system and its wider environment. In other words, decoherence. Talking extensively with Wheeler about his ideas, Wheeler was absolutely essential in defining the problem, or rather, the whole set of problems, he recalled. Zurek drafted a paper on decoherence in early 1981. Though Zurek hadn't been directly aware of Zee's earlier work on the subject, Wheeler certainly was. After hearing about Zee's ideas from Wigner, Wheeler had gone to visit Zee in Heidelberg the previous May. Soon after completing his draft, Zurek heard about Zee's work from Wheeler and Wigner. When Zurek's paper on decoherence was published later that year, Zurek cited Zee's still obscure work as a forerunner of his own. Although the content of their work had strong similarities, Zurek's approach to decoherence was very different from Zee's. Zee had promoted his idea that the many worlds interpretation was an unavoidable consequence of decoherence in his first papers on the subject. But Zurek was fairly agnostic about the interpretation of quantum physics. According to Zurek, "The whole point of my paper, and more broadly of my approach to decoherence, was that I could say things that were relevant to foundational questions and that followed directly from quantum theory, without any interpretational baggage attached." And Zurek's work was received very differently from Zee's. Unsurprising, given the difference in their approaches and the large changes that had happened in physics in the previous decade. While Zee had found it difficult to publish his ideas at all, Zurek's work was published in a prominent physics journal without much trouble. And Zurek also had a powerful sponsor in Wheeler. Again, unlike Zee, whose work on decoherence had painfully ruined his relationship with his mentor, Jensen. In addition to serving as a sounding board and encouraging Zurek's work, Wheeler helped secure invitations for Zurek to meetings on quantum foundations, which would not normally have been accessible to such a junior researcher. Zurek's talks and ideas were received well at these conferences, which further convinced him to spend much of his professional efforts on the foundations of quantum physics. "I had been under the impression that quantum foundations was a kiss of death to a physicist's career," Zurek recalled. During my student days, this was the message I had gotten from essentially everyone, with the notable exception of Wheeler. So getting invited to meetings on the basis of my foundation's research was solid evidence that times were a-changin'. Surik published half a dozen more papers on decoherence in the next 5 years, as well as several other papers on quantum foundations, none of which visibly hampered his career, which took him from Texas to Caltech and ultimately to Los Alamos. The success of Zurich's papers convinced C the time was right to start working on decoherence again. He took on a promising young student, Eric Jos, and wrote several papers with him on decoherence. But C didn't want his descent from Copenhagen to impact Jos. A young man should not immediately ruin his career by talking about Everett, C told Jos when they first started working together. So we'll write this paper without ever mentioning that. C deliberately avoided talking about Everett altogether for several years after Zurich's papers appeared, in a vain attempt to safeguard Jos's career. But despite the excellent work that C, Jos, Zurich, and others were doing on decoherence, C's colleagues in Heidelberg were still unconvinced that it was real physics, when they were aware of it at all. In 1990, I had the idea that I might suggest Jos for his habilitation, the second PhD required in Germany for anyone lecturing at a university, C recalled. I suggested that to some of the people who could have influenced that. Well, the answer was, what has he done? I said, decoherence. They replied, decoherence, what is that? In 1990. Decoherence finally found a broader audience of physicists in 1991, when Zurich wrote an article on the subject for Physics Today, the magazine of the American Physical Society. But Zurek's article made some controversial statements about decoherence. In particular, it came close to implying that decoherence could solve the measurement problem single-handedly. In spite of the profound nature of the difficulties, recent years have seen a growing consensus that progress is being made in dealing with the measurement problem, Zurek wrote. Macroscopic systems are never isolated from their environments. The resulting decoherence cannot be ignored when one addresses the problem of the collapse of the quantum mechanical wave packet. And toward the end of the article, he stated bluntly that decoherence destroys superpositions. A flurry of letters to Physics Today pushed back on Zurich, pointing out that decoherence couldn't solve the measurement problem in the absence of an interpretation to go along with it. For a small object in a Schrödinger's cat-like superposition of states put in contact with its environment, decoherence wouldn't destroy the superposition, it would make it worse. Instead of merely having the object in a superposition, the bigger system of object and environment would itself be in a superposition. And, without an interpretation to explain what that superposition means, the measurement problem would remain. Why don't we ever see dead and alive cats in the real world? Why does the Schrödinger equation work so well for small objects, yet appears to fail so miserably for the objects of everyday life? C unsurprisingly agreed that environment-induced decoherence by itself does not solve the measurement problem. He contended that Everett's many-worlds interpretation was needed to complete the picture. And Zurich, despite his Physics Today article, did agree that decoherence was not the whole solution. He had been much clearer about this in his very first paper on decoherence, where he said explicitly that decoherence could not address the question of what causes the collapse of the system apparatus environment combined wave function. But Zurich's views on many worlds weren't like T's. Instead, they were somewhat reminiscent of those of his mentor, Wheeler. Zurich tried to find a diplomatic way to reconcile Everett's many worlds with Bohr's Copenhagen interpretation, just as Wheeler had attempted on his ill-fated trip to Copenhagen in 1956. Unfortunately, many physicists took Zurich's diplomatic approach as a sign that decoherence somehow vindicated the Copenhagen interpretation. to them, decoherence was, like the Copenhagen interpretation itself, a magic phrase that could be invoked to dispel the specter of the measurement problem and the rest of the halo of weirdness surrounding quantum theory. Experiments probing decoherence in the late 1990s only added fuel to the fire. As the quantitative predictions of decoherence were confirmed, some physicists concluded that the measurement problem had finally been laid to rest. Among many others, Philip Anderson, the same physicist who had accepted Bell's theorem for publication, apparently on the erroneous understanding that Bell had ruled out Bohm's pilot wave theory, fell victim to this error. In 2001, he stated that decoherence describes the process that used to be called collapse of the wave function. The concept is now experimentally verified by beautiful atomic beam techniques quantifying the whole process. Anderson's misunderstanding about the nature of decoherence, like his misunderstanding of Bell's result, was definitely not due to any serious deficiency as a physicist on his part. Anderson won the Nobel Prize in 1977 for his seminal contributions to solid-state physics. He is also one of the architects of the modern standard model of particle physics. His errors were merely a sign of the times. Quantum foundations had become so complex so quickly that it was difficult for even the best physicists to speak intelligently about the subject if they didn't specialize in it. And because Copenhagen-fueled preconceptions about quantum physics remained so ingrained, it was difficult for physicists to see that this was the case. Jeff Bubb, Bohm's former student and a philosopher of quantum physics, lamented this state of affairs in 1997. The new orthodoxy appears to center now on the idea that the original Copenhagen interpretation has been vindicated by the recent technical results on environmental decoherence, wrote Bubb. He argued that there is no real advance here with respect to Einstein's qualms about the Copenhagen interpretation. It is still a gentle pillow for the true believer, perhaps now with that added attraction of a rather fancy goose-down comforter. Z, for his part, had been worried about this outcome from the start. I expect that the Copenhagen interpretation will sometime be called the greatest sophism in the history of science, he wrote to Wheeler in 1980. But I would consider it a terrible injustice if, when someday a solution should be found, some people claim that this is of course what Bohr always meant, only because he was sufficiently vague. During his time in Texas, Wheeler was also one of the animating forces behind a new set of ideas about quantum foundations. Quantum interpretations were proliferating wildly in the 1980s and 1990s, with suggestive new ideas taking flight alongside revitalized old ones. And the most prolific class of new interpretations was based on information theory. Taking inspiration from the work being done in quantum computation and cryptography, these interpretations proposed using the theoretical underpinnings of computer science to solve the difficult problems at the heart of quantum foundations. Wheeler was among the earliest proponents of this approach. He summed up the concept as it from bit. Find a way to ground reality itself, as described in quantum physics, in the notion of information. The motivation behind the information theoretic interpretations was relatively simple. If the wave function is information of some sort, rather than being a physical object, then many of the puzzles at the heart of quantum physics seem to melt away. In particular, the measurement problem seems much easier to explain if the wave function is information. Your information changes when you make a measurement, so it's no surprise that wave functions change dramatically when measurements occur. And the EPR experiment and Bell's theorem might become less puzzling too. When two photons with entangled polarization go flying off in opposite directions, and we measure the polarization of one of them, we do instantly learn the polarization of the other one. But there's nothing mysterious or non-local about that. any more than there's something mysterious or non-local about being able to instantly infer the time in Buenos Aires by looking at a clock in Beijing. And since there's nothing non-local about this, there's no longer any puzzle about why entanglement can't be used for faster-than-light communication. Except that can't quite be right, as any advocate of information-theoretic interpretations would point out. Bell's theorem explicitly states that photon polarizations can't be like clocks, nor like Bertelmann's socks. If wave functions are information rather than objects in themselves, they must be information of a rather peculiar sort. Whose information? Demanded John Bell. Information about what? To resolve the measurement problem, information theoretic interpretations had to answer these questions. The most immediate and Copenhagen-friendly answers were my information and information about my observations. But to Bell, such answers were profoundly inadequate. Placing observation at the center of physics smacked of positivism, a philosophy that Bell had entertained and rejected during his college days, concluding that it led inevitably to solipsism. Solipsism, the idea that you are the only person and everyone and everything else is merely a hallucination of some kind in your own mind, was a problem that had haunted positivism from the start. Information-based interpretations of quantum physics ran the risk of collapsing into solipsism as well. If the information that the wave function represented was your information, what makes you so special? And how could different observers agree on the same information? How could your information appear to be an objective fact in the world, something capable of creating interference patterns, plain for all to see? Some physicists tried to address these questions about information-theoretic interpretations by stating that the wave function was information about an unseen world underlying quantum physics, one that obeyed different and, as yet, undiscovered laws. But such a world would have to be non-local to satisfy Bell's theorem, in which case, much of the appeal of the information-theoretic interpretations was lost. Wheeler himself misunderstood the Bell experiments as ruling out determinism rather than locality. Others attempted to get around Bell's theorem by altering the laws of probability, or breaking one of the other handful of assumptions that entered into Bell's proof. But each of these solutions came with its own strange and difficult problems. None of these problems meant that information-theoretic interpretations couldn't work. These were challenges that would have to be met or convincingly dismissed, and physicists and philosophers interested in information-theoretic interpretations worked on doing just that. But for some physicists, the simple idea of the wave function as information held the same allure as decoherence, the promise of a quick and easy way to dismiss niggling doubts about the measurement problem. Wheeler said that his interpretation for it from bit was Bohr's approach to quantum physics. Some took this to mean that this was what Bohr himself had meant all along, that the Copenhagen interpretation was, and always had been, merely stating that the wave function was information, flatly refusing to answer what it was information about, that this was the one true way to understand quantum physics. Bell, of course, knew that there was nothing in quantum physics or in his own theorems that led inexorably to the Copenhagen interpretation. He had been promoting pilot wave theory for decades to illustrate precisely this point. Why is the pilot wave picture ignored in textbooks? Bell asked in 1982. Should it not be taught, not as the only way, but as an antidote to the prevailing complacency, to show that vagueness, subjectivity, and indeterminism are not forced on us by experimental facts, but by deliberate theoretical choice? But not long after Bohm returned to pilot wave theory, Bell took up the banner of one of the newer ideas being developed at the time: spontaneous collapse theory. Rather than interpreting the existing mathematics of quantum physics, as Bohm and Everett had done, spontaneous collapse theory actually modifies the equations of quantum physics to solve the measurement problem. It does so in a subtle way, as it would have to, since quantum physics is spectacularly successful in predicting the outcomes of experiments. But spontaneous collapse theory manages to leave most of the predictions of standard quantum physics intact, while altering them enough to solve the measurement problem. In spontaneous collapse theory, the quantum wave function is real, but it doesn't obey the Schrödinger equation perfectly. Instead, sometimes the wave function collapses. But this collapse has nothing to do with observation or measurement. The collapse happens entirely at random, for no reason at all, whether or not anyone is looking. Think of the wave function as playing a collapse slot machine. See figure 10.3a. Every time the wave function hits the jackpot, it collapses. It pulls the handle millions of times a second, but the collapse jackpot only comes up once every 10 million billion billion times or so. A 1 with 25 zeros after it. So it takes hundreds of billions of years for the wave function to collapse. This means that subatomic particles can almost always go down two paths at once, just like our nanometer Hamlet in the introduction. But every once in a very great while, they're forced to a single path. Just how great a while is a matter to be resolved by experiment, but it must be at least tens of thousands of years. Otherwise, the theory would contradict existing experiments. Yet this still leaves us with the question from the introduction. If subatomic particles can behave so strangely, and we and the objects in our everyday lives are composed of such particles, why don't we see such strange behavior on a regular basis? According to spontaneous collapse theory, the answer lies in two key facts: entanglement and the vast number of particles that comprise the objects of our everyday experience. Though a single particle wave function might not collapse on average until a billion years have passed, the solid objects of our everyday lives, like this book, are generally composed of at least 10 million billion billion individual particles. If each one of those particles' wave functions is compulsively pulling the handle of its own slot machine, see figure 10.3b, then on average, at least one of them will hit the collapse jackpot every millionth of a second. But because the particles in this book are all continually interacting with each other, they're all entangled, which means they all share a single wave function. So when one of them hits the jackpot, the wave function for the entire book collapses, meaning this book can't be in two places at once for much longer than a microsecond or so, 100,000 times faster than the blink of an eye. As Bell put it, in spontaneous collapse theory, Schrödinger's cat is not both dead and alive for more than a split second. This neatly resolves the measurement problem. All objects, large and small, obey the same laws, with no special role played by measurement. Wave function collapse happens at random to everything, all the time, without any need for intervention from an observer. Spontaneous collapse theory isn't really just one theory. It's a collection of related theories, which were developed by a small handful of people dissatisfied with the Copenhagen interpretation over the years. The one described above, the one that caught Bell's attention, and through him the attention of many other physicists, was developed in 1985 by a trio of physicists working in Italy: Giancarlo Girardi, Alberto Rimini, and Tullio Weber. It came to be known as the GRW model, after their initials. I see the GRW model as a very nice illustration of how quantum mechanics, to become rational, requires only a change which is very small on some measures, Bell wrote soon after the GRW paper first appeared. Bell's paper on GRW brought it to the attention of many other physicists, including Philip Perl, who had been working on similar ideas since the 1970s. 10 years earlier, Perel's work had also singled him out for the unfortunate distinction of an interview with a sociologist studying social deviance among physicists. Perel wrote to Bell for more information on GRW, and Bell arranged for Perel to spend a sabbatical with Girardi, where the two men attempted to adapt GRW for relativistic quantum field theory. But the common refrain that had greeted Bohm, Everett, and others for decades hit GRW and Perel doubly hard. Quantum theory works astonishingly well. Why fix what is manifestly not broken? Why do we even need a different interpretation, much less a different theory altogether? Bell framed his reply as a moral issue. It is not right to tell the public that a central role for conscious mind is integrated into modern atomic physics, or that information is the real stuff of physical theory. It seems to me irresponsible to suggest that technical features of contemporary theory were anticipated by the saints of ancient religions, by introspection. Bell felt an urgent need to solve the problems at the core of quantum physics, but he had little patience for purported solutions that were little more than vague declarations of faith. He wanted something more definite, something that wasn't a professional embarrassment, a true theory that didn't shy away from questions about what happened during measurement. His relentlessly clear writing gave no quarter to anyone hoping to take solace in the comforting platitudes of the Copenhagen interpretation. Surely, after 62 years, we should have an exact formulation of some part of quantum mechanics, Bell said in 1989. Measurement devices should not be separated off from the rest of the world into black boxes, as if they were not made of atoms and not ruled by quantum mechanics. In a talk he gave in Geneva in January 1990, Bell acknowledged that the task at hand was difficult and that his own theorem proved that there was some radical change necessary, something that physics would have to come to terms with. "I think you're stuck with the non-locality," Bell told the small group who had come to hear him speak that day. "I don't know any conception of locality which works with quantum mechanics." 8 months later, Bell died suddenly of a massive stroke at the age of 62. Memories and tributes poured in from his colleagues and friends. "He was one of the most rigorously honest men ever, and I never met anything like it myself. He was awesome," Abner Shimoni recalled. "Bell proved Bell's theorem, and no one else did, because of his character. Of course, he had a tremendous intellect, but what he had to such a superlative degree was the honesty, the tenacity to push through his questions." John Bell had a consuming commitment to wrestling an understanding of the natural world from the great theories of physics, wrote Merman and Kurt Gottfried, a physicist who had sparred with Bell over the Copenhagen interpretation several times. He held that a theory that merely succeeded in accounting brilliantly for data without providing a satisfactory understanding of what it described should be subject to stringent critical scrutiny. And if such an understanding was found to be unattainable, the theory should be expected to crumble, its superficial triumphs notwithstanding. John was truly unique in the world of physics, as a personality and as an intellect, at once scientist, philosopher, and humanist. He was a person to whom deep ideas mattered deeply. Fate has been most cruel to steal him from us when he was still so brimful of vitality. Bell had spent a quarter century fighting the overwhelming dominance of the Copenhagen interpretation. "Trust me, you could not do what Bell has done without a strong personality," said Gisson. "He would have been destroyed." Instead, Bell thrived, not only weakening the Copenhagen interpretation more than anyone since Einstein, but also discovering a profound new truth about nature in the process. "Non-locality, I think, was Bell's great discovery," said Bertelmann. "I think it is one of the greatest discoveries in the last century that there is non-locality in nature." Yet Bell, a modest man, did not receive the recognition and accolades he deserved in his lifetime for his work. Several years before Bell's death, he and Bertelmann were having tea in the outdoor cafeteria at CERN, enjoying the views of the Alps and the Jura in the afternoon sun, when Bertelmann mentioned that he thought Bell had been sold short. "I just suddenly said to him, 'John, I think you deserve the Nobel Prize,'" Bertelmann recalled. He was surprised and asked, "Why?" I said, "Because of Bell's theorem." Bell pointed out that the experimental tests of his theorem had not shown any deviation from quantum physics, which was not worthy of a Nobel Prize. "And besides," he added, "I don't think I deserve it because I stick to Nobel's original rules, and I do not see how my inequalities could contribute to the benefit of mankind." Alfred Nobel had originally stipulated that the prizes were to be given to people who had contributed most to the benefit of humanity in the previous year through work in their field. Bertelmann protested. I replied, "No, I don't agree. I think it is non-locality that is worthy of the prize." Then, on the one hand he was pleased, but on the other hand he was saying, a bit disappointed and sadly, "Who cares about this non-locality?" So he felt that the community did not realize this enough or did not appreciate this enough. I mean, it was clear at CERN. He was highly appreciated there as a particle physicist. But his work in quantum physics was not appreciated. Unbeknownst to Bell, he was shortlisted for the Nobel Prize the year before he died, and might well have won it had he lived longer. But the Nobel Prize isn't awarded posthumously, another stipulation of Alfred Nobel's will. Yet Bell's legacy was assured, though he did not live to see it. "The great boom came in the 90s with quantum information," said Bertelmann. "It is a new community now, which was not there in the 80s. So actually, he could not see the fruits of his work." Bell, through his profound physical insights and his pellucid, urgent prose, had managed to shift the mindset of physics as a whole, and had unintentionally conjured the entirely new field of quantum information processing out of thin air at the same time. And his contributions to quantum engineering, his work on particle physics and accelerator design at CERN, was of the very first rank. Bell also left behind a research program in quantum foundations. The year before he died, at a conference in the mountain village of Erice, on the western tip of Sicily, Bell delivered what came close to being the most spellbinding lecture I have ever heard, Merman later recalled. "What exactly qualifies some physical systems to play the role of measurer?" Bell asked, dripping with sarcasm. "Was the wave function of the world waiting to jump for thousands of millions of years until a single-celled living creature appeared? Or did it have to wait a little longer for some better qualified system? With a PhD?" Bell then pointed out the flaws in how quantum physics was commonly taught, taking several specific textbooks to task for their lapses in explanation, and finally laid out the two approaches to quantum physics that he thought were the most promising: the pilot wave interpretation and spontaneous collapse theory. He concluded his talk with a challenge. "The big question, in my opinion, is which, if either, of these two precise pictures can be redeveloped in a way consistent with special relativity." But Bell also entertained a third option. Beyond pilot waves and spontaneous collapse, though he did not mention it in his talk at Erice, "the many-world interpretation seems to me an extravagant and, above all, an extravagantly vague hypothesis," Bell said in 1986. "I could almost dismiss it as silly. And yet, it may have something distinctive to say in connection with the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen puzzle. And it would be worthwhile, I think, to formulate some precise version of it to see if this is really so. And the existence of all possible worlds may make us more comfortable about the existence of our own world, which seems to be, in some ways, a highly improbable one." Though the number of physicists interested in pilot waves and spontaneous collapse grew after Bell's death, the many worlds interpretation gained far more popularity and notoriety in the last decades of the 20th century. And much of the reason had nothing to do with Bell's work or any work in quantum physics at all. Instead, many worlds came roaring back thanks to research in an entirely different field of physics, a field that studied not the ridiculously small, but the unthinkably huge, the entire universe itself. 11. Copenhagen versus the universe. If a poll were conducted among physicists, Bryce DeWitt wrote in 1970, the majority would profess membership in the Copenhagen camp, just as most Americans would claim to believe in the Bill of Rights, whether they had ever read it or not. DeWitt had managed to convince the editor of Physics Today, the monthly magazine for members of the American Physical Society, to publish an article on the foundations of quantum physics. In a sign of the times, the editor, Hobart Ellis Jr., had not been particularly difficult to convince. For a long time, I personally have been dissatisfied with the apparent contradictions that physicists appear to be ready to live with in quantum mechanics and its interpretation, he wrote to DeWitt. I think a general review of different interpretations of quantum mechanics without special emphasis on any one would be of interest. DeWitt's article, Quantum Mechanics and Reality, did review several interpretations, but DeWitt made his own opinions quite clear. The Copenhagen view promotes the impression that the collapse of the wave function, and even the wave function itself, is all in the mind, he wrote. If this impression is correct, then what becomes of reality? How can one treat so cavalierly the objective world that obviously exists all around us? When dealing with a system in a quantum superposition, like Schrödinger's cat, DeWitt said most physicists conceive the measurement device to have entered a kind of schizophrenic state in which it is unable to decide what value it has found for the system, a living cat or a dead one. This problem, he concluded, was not resolved by the Copenhagen interpretation, and other interpretations, like Bohm's, added hidden variables to quantum physics, a move that DeWitt thought was unnecessary. What if we assert that the Schrödinger equation is all, that nothing else is needed, he wrote in Physics Today. Can we get away with it? The answer is that we can. DeWitt used the rest of the article to advocate Hugh Everett's relative state interpretation of quantum physics, which DeWitt had subscribed to since his correspondence with Everett in 1957. Everett had never talked explicitly about many worlds, but DeWitt ventured where Everett hadn't bothered to tread, rechristening the idea as the many worlds interpretation. The universe is constantly splitting into a stupendous number of branches, all resulting from the measurement-like interactions between its myriad of components, DeWitt wrote. Moreover, every quantum transition taking place on every star, in every galaxy, in every remote corner of the universe, is splitting our local world on Earth into myriads of copies of itself. DeWitt knew that this idea was dazzlingly strange. I still recall vividly the shock I experienced on first encountering this multi-world concept. The idea of 10 to the 100 plus slightly imperfect copies of oneself all constantly splitting into further copies which ultimately become unrecognizable is not easy to reconcile with common sense. Here is schizophrenia with a vengeance. Nonetheless, DeWitt argued, many worlds has a better claim than most to be the natural end product of the interpretation program begun by Heisenberg in 1925. He pointed out that the interpretation does not require wave functions to ever collapse, and claimed that it didn't require anything else at all. Many readers of Physics Today were unconvinced by DeWitt's arguments. The idea of infinitely many multiplying non-interacting worlds should be taken somewhat less seriously than the Ptolemaic, Earth-centered systems, epicycles, wrote one physicist in reply. At least Ptolemy's theory explained, in some sense, the one observable world without invoking infinitely many unobservable worlds. The many worlds interpretation would also imply the happy feeling that if an airline passenger were in an aircraft about to crash, he need not really worry, for in another world the same aircraft will land at home safe and sound, wrote another. I ask whether it is really necessary to go to such extreme lengths of straining physical sensibilities, admitting that here I speak for myself, to resolve the logical difficulties of the quantum theory. but DeWitt remained convinced, and some of his readers were swayed as well. Everett's interpretation had spent over a decade in deep obscurity. Now, one of the best-kept secrets of this century, as DeWitt called it, was finally out. DeWitt's enthusiasm for the many worlds interpretation was not merely driven by a desire to resolve the mysteries of quantum physics. Replying to his critics in Physics Today, DeWitt wrote that many worlds is the only conception that, within the framework of presently accepted equations and mathematics, permits quantum theory to play a role at the very foundations of cosmology. At the time DeWitt was writing, cosmology was more established as a research field than the foundations of quantum physics was. But that wasn't saying very much. The idea that the universe as a whole was a suitable subject for scientific investigation was difficult for some physicists to swallow. General relativity, Einstein's theory of gravity and warped space-time that underpins cosmology, was a theoretical backwater, an accepted theory that was nonetheless considered to be useless. Einstein's theory only differs appreciably from Newtonian gravity when dealing with extremely massive objects, objects at least as big as stars. But these massive objects that it dealt in were considered to be too far removed from everyday experience to be relevant to physics, and opinion was split over whether the theory's implications for cosmology should be taken seriously at all. In 1962, a young physics student named Kip Thorne had just finished his undergraduate degree at Caltech and was about to go off to study general relativity at Princeton under John Wheeler. One of his Caltech professors attempted to dissuade him. "General relativity has little relevance for the real world," Thorne recalled his professor telling him. "One should look elsewhere for interesting physics challenges." General relativity didn't merely deal with abstruse situations. It was also written in abstruse mathematics. The theory is very mathematically complex, far more so than quantum mechanics. Einstein famously had to enlist the help of a mathematician friend, Marcel Grossmann, just to learn the differential geometry necessary to formulate and understand his own theory. This combination of unfamiliar subject matter and obscure mathematics made it difficult to be sure of what the theory was saying, and led many physicists to be suspicious of its conclusions. Even Einstein himself had trouble accepting the consequences of his own theory after he initially developed and published it in 1915. He realized that general relativity implied the universe as a whole must be either contracting or expanding, a conclusion he found troubling, at odds with all known data at the time. So he put in a cosmological constant, a fudge factor to keep the universe at a static size. But in 1929, the astronomer Edwin Hubble discovered that distant galaxies appeared to be receding at a rate proportional to their distance, exactly what you would expect to see in an expanding universe. Einstein readily dismissed his ad hoc cosmological constant. He had never liked it anyhow, calling it gravely detrimental to the beauty of the theory, and accepted the cosmological picture presented by general relativity as correct. But not everyone was convinced, including Edwin Hubble himself. Hubble and others thought that distant galaxies only appeared to be receding, and that the universe was in fact static. Others agreed the universe was expanding, but they proposed modifications to the laws of physics that would ensure the universe looked basically the same at all times in the past and future, despite its expansion. This came to be known as the steady-state theory of the universe. For decades afterward, the steady-state theory was considered a reasonable scientific theory, and many physicists found it quite a bit more reasonable than the expanding universe of general relativity. After all, such a universe must have once been in a fabulously hot, dense, and small state, expanding rapidly, what steady-state theorist Fred Hoyle termed a Big Bang. General relativity, Hoyle and others held, was not necessarily to be trusted under such strange conditions, nor when applied to the universe as a whole. Meanwhile, confusion persisted about the implications of general relativity, even for objects much smaller than the entire universe, like stars. In 1938, Robert Oppenheimer and his student, George Volkoff at Berkeley, along with Richard Tolman at Caltech, used a very early forerunner of a computer to calculate that supermassive stars, far larger than our sun, must end their lives by collapsing down to a fabulously dense object from which nothing, not even light, can escape. The notion of these collapsed stars, as they were known then, generated intense debate. The forbidding mathematical edifice of general relativity, along with the computational intensity and unusual, at the time, tools required for the Oppenheimer-Volkoff calculation, not to mention the sheer strangeness of their result, made it difficult for other physicists to take the idea of collapsed stars seriously. This mathematical complexity also made it hard for Einstein to understand the implications of his own theory. Together with a young collaborator, I arrived at the interesting result that gravitational waves do not exist, Einstein wrote to his old friend, Max Born, in 1936. Gravitational waves, ripples in spacetime, formed by colliding hyperdense stars and similarly intense events, racing out at the speed of light from their violent births, were a unique prediction of general relativity, not found in Newton's theory of gravity. But the strange mathematics of the new theory led Einstein and his collaborator Rosen astray. They published a paper claiming to prove that gravitational waves aren't physical objects and are merely mathematical fictions of the theory. Einstein was later set straight by the American physicist Howard Percy Robertson, but Rosen remained unconvinced that gravitational waves were real, and his paper with Einstein was never retracted, leading to a great deal of confusion about the reality of one of the fundamental predictions of general relativity, a confusion that persisted for decades. The mathematical difficulty of the theory, the confusing arguments surrounding its predictions, and the remoteness of its predictions from the realm of experiment left general relativity off to the side as physics boomed after World War II. The new sources of scientific funding that flowed from the military-industrial complex largely ignored general relativity. But in the late 1950s, the field slowly began to blossom. Several conferences were held on the subject, and a professional community of relativistic astrophysicists and cosmologists began to form. One of the most important of these conferences was the 1957 Chapel Hill Conference, organized by Bryce DeWitt and Cécile DeWitt-Moret, a talented physicist who had studied with de Broglie in France and who was married to Bryce DeWitt. A variety of physics luminaries descended on Chapel Hill for the conference. Aside from the DeWitts, John Wheeler was there, as was his student and Everett's friend, Charles Meissner. Feynman was there too, but he registered under a pseudonym, Mr. Smith, to protest the sorry state of research in the field. At the conference, Feynman and physicist Hermann Bondi presented closely related ironclad arguments that finally convinced the physics community that gravitational waves must be real if general relativity was correct, clearing up a major embarrassment for the still nascent research field. This also kicked off a 60-year search for gravitational waves, ultimately culminating in the first successful detection of gravitational waves at LIGO, a pair of 4-kilometer-long, laser-powered gravitational wave observatories in 2015, an accomplishment that earned a Nobel Prize for Thorne and two of his colleagues in 2017. And Wheeler, meanwhile, pushed his agenda of radical conservatism, taking the predictions of established theories seriously, even in wildly strange, untested, and remote domains. For example, the small, hot, dense period in the universe's history immediately after the still controversial Big Bang, when both general relativity and quantum physics would be necessary for understanding the behavior of the universe. In the 1960s, the new field accelerated significantly. New mathematical techniques led to the realization that collapsed stars, or, as John Wheeler dubbed them in 1968, black holes, must be real. And in 1964, two physicists at Bell Labs, Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson, stumbled upon a radio hiss coming from all directions in the sky, and realized that they had discovered the CMB radiation, the oldest light in the universe and an echo of the Big Bang. Within 15 years, the steady-state theory had lost all credibility. The Big Bang model was accepted as basically correct, and Penzias and Wilson had shared a Nobel Prize. There was still a great deal of disagreement about basic questions, like the rate at which the universe was expanding. But relativistic cosmology was finally off and running, with a shared model of how the universe as a whole behaves. But the rise of cosmology made the inadequacy of the Copenhagen interpretation more acute. How can you draw a line between the observer and the observed system as Bohr had required, when the system in question is the entire universe? Quantum gravity is certainly going to be important in the early moments of the universe. Then you are driven to the notion of a wave function for the universe, and how do you interpret a thing like that when there's no observer outside, DeWitt said. The Everett point of view was the only way of doing this. In the late 1960s, as Clauser and others were first discovering Bell's theorem and devising ways to test it, DeWitt started spreading the gospel of Everett among cosmologists and astrophysicists. I felt that Everett had been given a raw deal, DeWitt said. He gave a talk on Everett's theory in 1967 at a Seattle conference on relativistic astrophysics and cosmology that Wheeler and DeWitt Moret organized together. He managed to get Physics Today to publish his article on the subject, which he later said was deliberately written in a sensational style. He uncovered Everett's original, longer version of his thesis, significantly easier to understand than the edited-down version that Wheeler had insisted on, and published it, along with other works of Everett's, similar work from others, and responses from other physicists, in a volume he edited along with his student, Neil Graham, published in 1973. The classic science fiction magazine Analog even ran an article on the many worlds interpretation, mostly based on DeWitt's Physics Today article in December 1976. And in 1977, DeWitt and Wheeler asked Everett himself to give a seminar on his interpretation. Everett accepted and drove from his sleepy Virginia suburb down to Austin with his wife and two teenaged kids to give his first talk on quantum physics in 15 years. On January 2, 1971, a White House courier and two U.S. Air Marshals took a red-eye flight from Washington, D.C. to Los Angeles. They were carrying classified information to National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger. Routine work, but sensitive. Needless to say, the courier and Marshals were startled when a portly, middle-aged man with a goatee snapped a picture of them with a small camera as he walked past their seats. Their alarm only intensified when they questioned him immediately afterward. He would only say that he had taken the picture for my files. He smelled of gin and Kent cigarettes. When the plane landed, the marshal lost sight of the mysterious man in the crowd, but an inquiry with the airline identified him as one Hugh Everett III. The marshals reported the incident with Everett to the FBI, who sent an agent to Everett's airport hotel room several hours later. By then, Everett had sobered up and sheepishly admitted to the FBI agent that he had merely been playing a practical joke on the courier and marshals. He had inferred their profession when he overheard their chatter in the Dulles Airport bar. The FBI agent, finally satisfied that no harm had been done and Everett was merely a man with a strange sense of humor, led Everett off with a warning and left him alone in his hotel room. Both the marshals and the FBI agent remained blissfully unaware that Everett himself had a security clearance that far outstripped their own. Everett had done reasonably well for himself over the previous 15 years since leaving Princeton and John Wheeler's tutelage. After 8 years working directly for the Pentagon, he had struck out on his own, founding a statistical consulting firm and contracting for his former employers. His optimization algorithm had made his reputation at the Pentagon, and his work provided him with enough income for the finer things in life he enjoyed. He spent his days gaming out various scenarios for nuclear apocalypse, and his evenings eating, smoking, and womanizing. He and his wife had agreed to an open marriage in the middle of the 1960s, though by then Everett had been conducting various short-lived affairs for years. By the time DeWitt and Wheeler invited him to the Austin conference in 1977, Everett was spending some of those evenings parked in front of his television with an early VCR, watching Dr. Strangelove, his favorite movie, on an endless loop, drink in hand. Everett was pleased that DeWitt had brought new attention to his ideas, and it tickled him to see his own theory discussed in the pages of the same science fiction magazines he had been reading all his life. "I certainly approve of the way Bryce DeWitt presented my theory," Everett wrote, "since without his efforts it would never have been presented at all." But it's not clear that Everett himself truly believed that the many worlds implied by his interpretation were literally real, as DeWitt did. Shortly after leaving Princeton, Everett corresponded with Philip Frank, a founding member of the positivist Vienna Circle. Their letters reveal that the two men shared similar philosophical inclinations.
"I find that you have expressed a viewpoint which is very nearly identical with the one which I have developed independently in the last few years concerning the nature of physical theory," Everett wrote to Frank in 1957.
Everett's dissatisfaction with Copenhagen had less to do with any commitment to realism and more to do with its irrational and inconsistent usage of the Schrödinger equation. Even from a positivist perspective, the measurement problem appeared grave to Everett. When does collapse happen? Why does the Schrödinger equation apply at some times but not others? Frank was clearly troubled by this too, as he wrote in his reply to Everett,
"I have always disliked the traditional treatment of measurement in quantum theory, according to which it seems as if measurement would be a type of fact which is essentially different from all other physical facts."
Rather than saving realism, as Bohm and Shimoni and others wanted to do, Everett had simply wanted to fix this hole in physics and to have a good time while doing it. He wanted a quick, short thesis project, and punking the measurement problem made him laugh, Everett's biographer Peter Byrne said. Everett had kept up with developments in the foundations of physics over the years, but he had never published anything on the subject after finishing his PhD thesis. He had certainly never spoken about it publicly. He hated public speaking, and he rarely even spoke about it with friends or colleagues. When Don Reisler, a physicist with a PhD in quantum foundations, applied to work at Everett's company, Everett shyly asked if he were aware of the relative state interpretation. Reisler immediately thought, "Oh my God, you are that Everett, the crazy one." He said he had heard of the theory. They became great friends, but they never spoke of quantum physics again. And even as awareness of Everett's ideas spread, they were still often met with ridicule and withering contempt. Writing about cognitive repression in contemporary physics, the physicist-turned-philosopher Evelyn Fox Keller said that the many-worlds interpretation demonstrates remarkable ingenuity in the solution it provides for the measurement problem and other quantum paradoxes. But, she concluded, a price has been paid, namely the price of seriousness. More criticism of Everett was yet to come, and not from some unknown quarter, but from an old ally. Shortly after Everett's Austin seminar, Wheeler received a draft of a paper criticizing the many worlds interpretation, which the paper termed the Everett-Wheeler interpretation. Wheeler hastily replied, pointing out that Everett's PhD thesis was on a topic entirely conceived by him and ought to be called the Everett interpretation, not the Everett-Wheeler interpretation. Ever the scientific diplomat, Wheeler had tried to maintain his commitment to the ideas of Bohr, his late mentor, without explicitly denouncing the ideas of Everett, his former student.
This wasn't a difficult position for him to hold while Everett's work languished in obscurity and remained cloaked in the language of the relative state formulation. But now DeWitt was calling Everett's view the many-worlds interpretation, and saying that Wheeler was partly responsible for it.